Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the science podcast. What do you think?
I think that's clear enough. Actually, I mean, you could clarify it a bit more. So, because there was a science program called Eureka that ran in the 1990s on Radio 4.
Was there?
Yeah. So, I mean, people might be confused about that. So maybe, hello and welcome to Eureka, the science podcast, not the science radio series that ran through the late 1990s on Radio 4, which actually was then sort of basically copied by Jim Al-Khalili and came into being as the Life Scientific.
Yeah, that's too long. What about...
Oh, okay.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the science podcast, not the boring Radio 4 one.
Yeah, that's quite good.
Because that actually covers off quite a few boring Radio 4 science podcasts.
I mean,
well,
if you say Radio 4, do you need to put boring in there?
Yeah. You think it's a tautology? Yeah, fine. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
So we did get a message in from Tim, who said this. It was a nice message. Hi, I'm a long time listener, first time caller, and blah 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 blah, all that bullshit. that he says that. Isn't your tagline Eureka, displacing the myths of science, or something to that effect? So that's quite clever.
That's really good.
The only thing that I don't like about it is we're not a myth busting show. I don't think that's what we do.
I mean, I think you're ruling him out on a technicality in some ways.
Yeah.
But his concept is very good.
Something in displacing, you know.
Yeah.
Displacing the scientific bullshit. Well, I don't know. Like.
Displacing the ignorance.
Displacing the ignorance. Maybe displacing the
science. I like what he's done there.
Yeah. Well, he then goes on to say, more importantly, can you please do an episode on the question, are we living in a simulation? Anyway, love and kisses. Your number one or thereabouts fan, Tim. Yes, I think we probably can do a simulation episode. The problem with that episode will be we have spent quite a lot of time talking about it in the past, and so it will be a very long episode where we both just spout loads of stuff that we know
about each other because we disagree fundamentally about things.
Yeah. But maybe that's a good episode. So yeah, we'll look into that for you, Tim, particularly as you came up with what is a half-decent tagline. Certainly more decent than most of the crap we've come up with so far. What are we talking about this week?
Oh, sadly, Tim didn't ask about, can we cover nuclear fusion? Because that's what we're going to do this week.
Yeah.
I mean,
I feel we've been resisting doing that for
so
a while.
So, exec
I
producer
exactly
Luke.
What going to say about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I mean, there is partly that. So I avoid this subject in some ways because I have quite strong feelings about it. I feel like it's overcovered in some ways, uncritically.
You don't trust any of them?
I don't trust any of the experts at all. There's a few of them now. I'm starting to think, okay, you know, you sound plausible and reasonable, and I'm going to take what you say. But loads of people who work in this field, I'd like take it with a huge pinch of salt. But
well, yeah, because they're on the promo trail.
They're on the make,
aren't
they?
They're pushing something.
Yeah, absolutely on the make.
Yeah.
But yeah, exec producer Luke has been banging on about doing this for a long time. Mm. I actually turned down writing a thing for New Scientist about it. Like they wanted me to do a feature on it. I was like, oh, I don't want to do it. But I'm finally giving in, partly because I read like this week that Germany's just shut all its nuclear reactors, which actually has a bearing on fusion.
Fission reactors.
Oh, it's fission reactors.
Yeah.
There's
no fusion reactors to shut.
No, yeah. And won't be for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And China's just done a big sort of fusion experiment and got quite a big sort of record, or so they claim. Mm. Obviously, you know, you can never quite be sure about what's going on. So I just thought maybe I should just give in, stop fighting it, and just, you know,
take a look. Have we got as our expert this week?
Well, you got me. Because I don't trust anyone else.
Of course we have. So, I mean, there have been various... I mean, obviously... The British government has said some amazing,
ridiculous things. I mean, Boris Johnson in particular,
and Jeremy Hunt, I think recently as well, has been talking about how we're going to make tons of money in the UK out of fusion. And he kept, was it Jeremy Hunt? Someone was talking about so just infinite clean energy. That sounds good.
Have we open the top, pour in this snake oil.
Yeah, snake oil burns forever. the nub of this is whether literally can we do it, and there have definitely been reports. I feel like more regularly about people doing stuff with their tokamak reactors where finally they're getting out marginally more energy than they're putting in, which is sort of...
Or are they?
This is why I think it's good that we do this episode, because I knew you'd be saying, or are they?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean,
because that's the holy grail. If you can do that, then you're like, right.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in some of the claims that have been made. And of course, you know, you get them in the newspapers, and they're just like they're just written as headlines. It's like, oh, amazing, we've done it, sort of thing.
Press releases.
But actually, when you dig under the surface, that's when it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm. 2, 1, 0.
This is the record-breaking reaction. It is more than 150 million degrees centigrade. 10 times hotter than the heart of the sun.
Nuclear fusion could meet all of our energy needs using nothing more than the hydrogen atoms found in seawater. Squeeze together two hydrogen atoms at a high enough temperature and pressure, they fuse together and release vast amounts of energy. This is the process that powers the sun. Scientists have been trying to replicate it on Earth for decades. And although it has proved extremely difficult, we've been making some progress. In fact, in recent years, several high-profile announcements have got everyone excited and caused a rush of money into the fusion field.
So today, we tell the world that America has achieved a tremendous scientific breakthrough. One that happened because we invested in our national labs and we invested in fundamental research. And tomorrow, we'll continue to work toward a future that is powered in part by fusion energy.
Fusion has the potential for abundant clean energy.
The trouble is, some say that nuclear fusion is a pipe dream and that money would be better spent on things like renewable energy research and other ways to fight climate change. So who's right? That's why this week we're asking, will we ever use nuclear fusion power?
All right, well, let's go right back to basics then. It happens in the sun. What's going on up there?
So it happens in the sun. You've got normal hydrogen atoms. They're there. It's like 15 million Kelvin, so 15 million degrees roughly.
It's hot.
It's really hot in the core of the sun. The pressure's massive, like 200 billion times greater than atmospheric pressure on Earth. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is those hydrogen atoms get pushed together. And they get to the point that they're pushed together so hard, so close, that they fuse together, creating basically helium.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this sort of, you know, massive reactor in the sky that's making helium, but also releasing vast amounts of energy from that reaction, from that fusion reaction. So every fusion of two hydrogen atoms mm-hmm. creates basically enough energy to keep a 60-watt light bulb shining for 100 years, roughly speaking.
Right.
So there's plenty of energy from just two atoms fusing together.
So all we need to do is recreate that on Earth.
Yes. I mean, you know, people have said this since the 1950s. It's obvious in a way. So obviously, you know, we can't create 500 times, you know, the 500 million times the atmospheric pressure. We can actually create higher temperatures
we can,
than the core of the sun. Mm-hmm. So we can do that. But so without the pressure, you have to up the temperature to about 100 million degrees.
Yeah.
But you can do that, mm-hmm. right? And that's sort of basically is enough if we use special forms of hydrogen. So we can't just use normal hydrogen. We have to use hydrogen with extra neutrons. So one extra neutron makes it deuterium, which is found in seawater.
Yeah.
And two extra neutrons makes it tritium, which is not found very often anywhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, the basic best way to do this fusion thing is to do deuterium and tritium fused together. Get your temperatures right up.
They're easier to fuse.
They're basically easier to fuse than just deuterium and deuterium. And what you do, and we've sort of been working on this for a long, long time, is you have to hold the fuel sort of and heat it up to the point where it's 100 million degrees using various sort of things like microwaves and beams of neutral ions, and you can heat it up and then it fuses.
The image of microwaves is funny, by the way. I know what you mean, but I'm picturing something else. Yeah. Your fusion's ready.
if only. So you create this thing called a plasma, which is a hot ionized gas, and it's charged. So you can hold it in magnetic fields. So you create these massive, super strong magnetic fields, hold the plasma in place, and then the fusion reactions can just keep going on and on, in theory.
Because there's not like a material that we have that can contain it. That's where you have to use magnetic
fields. It has to
be
something that's kept away from the sides of the container, basically, because that just destroys the plasma and destroys the fusion reaction. So what you have to do is contain this plasma somehow. And that's sort of doable. That's what these big reactors, the tokamak reactors, which are like a donut shape, do. And you use these strong magnetic fields to do it. And we started to be able to do that. And the recent Chinese advance, I think they held the reaction going on
for a few minutes, wasn't it?
No, 30 seconds, I think.
Was it
7 minutes?
I thought it was 7 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. Which is pretty good going.
So that's pretty good going if it's true. And so that's sort of fine. Basically, we've got the theory and we've got the basic practice of it.
And we know where to get we can get deuterium from seawater.
Yeah, one in every 5,000 hydrogen atoms in seawater is deuterium.
Great.
So you just sort of separate it out. That's fine. No problem at all. And a gallon of seawater gives you about 300 gallons of gasoline worth of energy. So there's plenty in seawater. Tritium is much more difficult. So tritium is basically really rare. Mm. It's produced in nuclear reactions. So the levels in the atmosphere
peaked
in the 1960s. We can, but we basically have to use a nuclear reactor to manufacture it, right? Yeah. So and they're all shutting down now. So this is part of the problem, is that it only has a half-life of 12.3 years, so it's radioactive. So every 12 years, half of it is gone.
So you have to keep making it. Yeah.
So the estimates are there's about 20 kilos of tritium on Earth right now.
A load of tritium at the back of the fridge. You're like, oh, fuck it, that's gone, that's off.
It's $30,000 a gram.
Okay. I don't really... I don't know if that's expensive.
Well,
working
fusion reactors will need about 200 kilograms a year. So it's...
Okay, but even that, I'm like, but how much energy is that producing? I mean...
Oh, it's doing... In some ways, it's doing all right. But the problem is we just don't have it, really. Mm-hmm. And you make it, and you have to make it in nuclear reactors at the moment. The idea is eventually that the fusion reactors will make their own tritium, but at the moment we don't have it. But yes, so we can sort of, we can see, we've got the basics of how to do it.
Yeah, so we in principle, we know how to do it.
Yeah.
We know we can get some of the fuel from seawater. Yeah. It kind of feels like we should be on top of this.
It sounds like it, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, oh, it's just an engineering problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Effectively. So we want to make a big, big tokamak because also there's economies of scale here, because in order to fire up the magnetic field, for instance, the superconducting magnets that you need for all that, that takes electricity and energy. So you've got this sort of problem with, just having to power the thing before you get any power out of it. Mm-hmm. So you have to make it quite big so that you get more power out than you're putting in. That's the idea. So the big sort of experimental idea at the moment is to build a huge reactor in the south of France called ITER, the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor.
Yeah.
And the seven countries, sort of, well, not countries because the EU is one of them, the China, EU, India, Japan, Russia, South Korea, and the US, all sort of banding together to create this thing just north of Marseille. And they're building this enormous, you know, tokamak that will then basically become, you know, the proof of principle that this is all going to work. The problem is in the details. So like, nobody knows how much this thing is actually costing.
Right.
Literally, it's a project without a price tag, because nobody's willing, because it's sort of done so that everyone keeps their own accounts, all the seven different.
And presumably it's probably a bit embarrassing, going, how much have you spent on this?
Yeah. So people are trying to make the estimate. So the EU, because everyone's doing a little extra bit of it themselves and commissioning in country, like their firms to do the bit, there's no proper central accounting or anything. But it started out. So when I first reported on this in 2009, it was about 10 billion euros they were saying it's going to cost. Okay, you think, well, that's fair enough, right. You know.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in 2017, the EU said, no, this is about 41 billion. And then the following year, the US said, actually, the cost, you know, if we work it out, it's about 60 billion. So it's just going up and up and up.
It's got real HS2 vibes.
it really has. I mean, it's a classic sort of mega engineering thing, isn't it? So people have basically stopped trying to work out how much it's going to cost because they've got other issues with it. So it's way behind schedule, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not actually meant to sort of do anything useful until 2035 anyway. So they're sort of saying, oh, 2035, we'll switch it on. We'll have tritium and deuterium in it, and then we'll see what it
not
does.
Not a bet I would want to take.
No, me neither. Me neither. Especially since the French Nuclear Safety Authority have just shut it down. Because they said, like, I mean, the vacuum vessel for these tokamaks, you know, they're like 17 meters tall and they're like 6 or 7 meters wide. And you have to fit them together to a fraction of a millimeter. And there's all kinds of issues because they're being made in different places.
Right.
And nobody's demonstrated that basically they have the right, you know, tolerance and machining. And they've also said that the welding is not like to nuclear standards yet. Or you're not showing us that you can actually weld these things properly yet. So the French authorities are just like, you're not doing this here while you're doing such a shoddy job. And that's, you know, so that's sort of putting it behind schedule again. So basically, we don't know if we can actually build the thing. And then the sort of there's a huge problem with worker dissatisfaction now, because the pressures are so high on the engineers building this kind of thing. And they're supposed to be producing...
Literally, because they're in there.
So that they're trying to sort of, you know, build this thing to these specifications within a certain timeline. The managers are, you know, making their lives hell. And in May 21, one of the engineers killed himself. And his note that he left said, I can't, you know, I've just been the scapegoat for all these ridiculous expectations. And all the other workers are basically, you know, then sort of said that the report into this didn't go anywhere deep enough. And they sort of downed tools for a while. So you've got all these sort of issues and they're sort of saying, right, we're going to have to do psychological counselling for all the engineers who are working on this thing. It doesn't smell good, basically.
It's a complete shit show.
It's a complete shit show. One of the safety, or a couple of the safety people have left. So the thing about the walls of ITER is it's all supposed to be covered in beryllium to absorb what are massively high energy neutrons given out by the thermonuclear reaction, the fusion reaction. The beryllium walls sort of absorb these neutrons. Otherwise, you basically build this thing and the neutrons destroy it as soon as you turn it on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a massive amount of energy being released. And 80% of that energy is in the neutrons that are just firing out of the thing.
Yeah.
So you coat it with beryllium. But beryllium is problematic in that if you're in contact with it, if you breathe it in or whatever, it gives you lung diseases. So there's the safety protocols, which ITER have basically tried to cut away at because it costs a lot of money. And so the people in charge of the safety protocols have just downed tools and left and said, you know, we're not working here anymore. And so there's just this sort of catalogue of problems when you actually try and build something on this scale. And let's remember, this thing isn't going to produce electricity. This is just like the demonstration thing.
It's proof of concept.
All these countries will then take away everything they've learned and go and build their own one.
Yeah. Which in theory would be easier if it's just one country doing it on their own rather than this mad sort of mishmash collaboration.
Well, you've got this problem that's happened. Obviously, the pandemic slowed everything down. Mm. And then it turns out there aren't enough ships to sort of just transport the stuff around the world. So it's all being delayed in terms of there's no transport. And the transport, of course, now is hugely expensive because it's in demand. Mm. So the costs are just going up. And you know, and so everybody's blaming everybody else for not delivering on their part of the project. So ITER is basically a colossal clusterfuck.
Yeah. But it's not the only game in town, is it, ITER? So
no.
There's a lot of private firms getting involved now. There's lots of chat of like mini reactors, mini fusion reactors, you know, various national efforts as well.
Yeah. So there is a lot going on, and all of it is sort of impressive engineering on its own. So you have things like the Joint European Torus in Oxford, the UK sort of effort, which set a new global fusion record in 2021, produced 59 megajoules of energy in a reaction that lasted 5 seconds. So,
which
is good, because it's better. Yeah. You know, it's better than we'd done before.
Yeah.
In South Korea last year, you had a 30-second fusion reaction, so that was good. These aren't necessarily producing more energy out than in.
Are they
by
not?
The way. No,
I thought that had been done though. In is it the Livermore Lab?
Yeah, the National Ignition Facility. So this is the thing that got Luke really excited and sort of said, "Oh, you know," because there were like headlines all over the world in this,
yeah.
And they made massive claims for it. So this is the National Ignition Facility. They've been trying for decades, basically, to put together. And they don't use a tokamak, so that they actually have the fuel sort of contained in a place, and they just fire 192 lasers at it, and so you get this incredible sort of, you know, heating and compression, and they had an announcement, I think, of December last year. The Department of Energy in the US said this is a major scientific breakthrough, decades in the making, that will pave the way for advancements in national defense and the future of clean power. And the Senate Majority Leader said, "This astonishing scientific advance puts us on the precipice of a future no longer reliant on fossil fuels, but instead powered by new clean fusion energy." Mm. And they said this because basically they were told, "We got more energy out than we put in."
It's bombastic stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's big. So they actually got out 3.15 megajoules of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how much that is?
It's not very much.
If you had a bit of kindling and burnt it, that's what you'd get.
Yeah, so and how much are they putting in?
Well, they said the lasers, what actually went into the fuel was 2.1 megajoules, so less than they got out. But what they didn't say was it probably took about 400 megajoules to fire up the lasers and get them going.
Okay.
So the incident energy on the pellet of fuel was less than
there is a net output,
but to get to that point, you've had to fire up 192 layers.
Is the argument though that is a fixed cost, if you like? So you fire them up, and that takes a load of energy. Then if you can get it to run for longer, then you will.
Yeah, so that ran for a fraction of a second, right?
Yeah.
But if you're gonna create a power plant from this, and the National Ignition Facility is not ever designed to be a power plant
or anything.
So it takes them a few hours to cool down the lasers so they can fire them again. So you can't just like keep repeating this whole thing.
You
can't just keep running. It's hours. And you know, you need to be running it sort of 60 times a minute if you're going to actually run a sort of power thing. So this is not a route to anything, basically. Mm. It's a proof of principle that you can, you know, put... sort of
a proof of principle that we already know is true. Like, yes, in theory, of course, we can do this.
Yeah. So, you know, forgive my skepticism, but I'm just trying to give you some context on all of this sort of, you know, breathless excitement about the whole thing.
All right. Should we take a break and let you calm down slightly? when we come back, we'll talk about why billions are being poured into fusion, what those investors maybe haven't thought about, and of course, we'll try and answer this week's question: will we ever use nuclear fusion power?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. So what have we actually achieved so far with Fusion then?
So we have some reactions where we're definitely getting fusion ignition.
Yeah.
That's happening.
So the process is happening.
The process is happening.
Controlled by us, directed by us.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we've sort of shown proof of principle. And you've got things like First Light Fusion, which is another Oxford company, because a lot of this is sort of focused around Oxford. And First Light actually spun out of Oxford University. Mm-hmm. And they've shown that they can create fusion in a system that, unlike the National Ignition Facility in the US, you could, in principle, turn it into a power station.
Into a power plant, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So they have this sort of, basically they fire a massive, a very small tungsten pellet into their deuterium tritium fuel and causes fusion. And they've seen like the neutrons flying out, and everyone agrees that, you know, definitely you've got fusion going on there. It's not more energy out than in their process yet, but they say, you know, this is a kind of way we could get this gun firing, you know, regularly, really quickly. We don't need to like spend ages cooling it down again. And then, you know, so we can turn this into a power source. And there's the Commonwealth Fusion Systems in the US, I think spun out of MIT, which has just raised like $1.8 billion recently. So a lot of money.
Mm.
And there's I think it's the last year, like $3 billion have gone into fusion around the world. So a lot of money. People are really sort of positive about it.
It does feel like there's a kind of momentum behind it at the moment. I don't really remember.
Yeah, I think that's true. But what we have is, you know, is we had sort of momentum around it probably like when JET turned on in Oxford, first of all. It's like, oh, we've got a fusion reactor in the making sort of thing. And there's still a lot to do. So lots of the kind of, you know, so like the First Light system, for instance, they're like, great, we could, you know, we've got neutrons flying out, we've got fusion going on. It's still more energy going in than coming out, but we'll work on that. And they're sort of saying, you know, we can just work on that.
Yeah.
And Commonwealth Fusion Systems say we're going to be producing electricity in 2030. They say, you know, we're just sort of, you know, less than 7 years away, effectively. But they don't say it'll be commercially valuable or anything. And First Light in Oxford now, they have to build a power plant around their thing. And building a power plant around it means basically you've got to have a way to turn all that fusion energy into something that drives a turbine. So like the sort of outside of it is like a normal sort of a nuclear plant or a coal plant or whatever. Is you create a load of steam to drive a turbine.
Yeah.
And they say they can do this by blanketing the whole thing in a sort of coat of liquid lithium, which is sort of flowing and it absorbs all the neutrons, absorbs all the heat and all the energy, and that gets transferred to a steam bath, which then drives a turbine. But they haven't built this yet, right? I mean, and they say, oh, you know, this is all sort of known technology. But actually, it's not known technology in terms of fusion and the sort of hostile environment that you've created. Mm. You know, you've got 100 million degrees, you've got neutrons flying around, you know, the incredibly high energy that if you build out of normal materials, they'll just fall apart.
Mm.
So you know, there are sort of issues with turning this into a kind of working fusion reactor.
Okay, so nevertheless, as discussed, there is a lot of investment going in at the moment.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to be optimistic?
It's ongoing. So interestingly, like when you talk to the experts, what the experts will tell you who've been in this industry a long time, mm-hmm. they'll say they don't really understand why these private investments are happening. You know, they don't understand what
the trigger has been.
What the trigger has been, because they're saying, you know, all these private firms, they haven't got some secret materials program going on where they've solved all the problems about how you build a reactor around these things. You know, ITER itself has huge problems with the materials and the surround for its tokamak. And that's just a basic sort of physics thing in that, you know, these highly energetic neutrons are coming out and destroying everything.
Yeah, and you've got to do something about that.
And you've got to do something about that. Mm. So you know, the basic guys and the ITER guys are saying this is a long-term problem to solve the sort of materials issues. So actually, you know, creating the fusion ignition things is kind of interesting and exciting, but it doesn't mean we're going to have commercial fusion power. So the figures I've seen from industry sort of insiders, there's a guy who's like part of the European government consortium for, you know, for fusion. He basically says, yeah, it looks like the 2060s will possibly have a commercial fusion power.
2060s. Yeah, okay.
So 40 years?
Yeah, I mean, doesn't seem as unrealistic. I mean, the classic thing is
it's always
been
40 years away, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's always been, is it not sort of always 20 years away?
No, 40, it's always either been 30 or 40.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're still in that phase.
Just keep on pushing it back.
So in the meantime, you know, lots of people like Greenpeace are saying, you know, why is all this investment going into this when we could be investing in, you know, batteries and renewables and solving climate change?
Well, I mean, yes, but if you do crack it, and I appreciate it's a big if, it's a game changer.
It is.
Like, the biggest.
But how long do you keep going with these sort of attempts to do it?
Probably until you crack it, I think.
Is that how things work?
Well, I don't. I mean, well,
I suppose if it's private investment,
yeah, if it's private investment, it depends how long they're prepared to wait, really, doesn't it? And who knows? I mean, I don't think they're massively patient. But in terms of the effect it could have, there's not a more significant game in town, is there?
No. But there is a problem now with like these nuclear reactors closing down and the lack of tritium because we cannot do it without tritium. So you can do it with deuterium reactions, but it's like 80% less efficient and requires higher temperatures. So we need to have that tritium, and it's just not there. Also, all of these things need loads of lithium to absorb the heat, and there's a massive lithium shortage already.
Yeah, because of batteries.
Yeah. So at the very worst, the escalating cost of lithium and the lack of lithium in the world is going to be a bit of a problem to these guys. You know, they're not going to be at the front of the queue.
No. So our issues are tritium. Really hard to get hold of.
Yeah. Also very poisonous if you release it into the environment.
Okay.
Which you would end up doing.
Would you?
Yeah. Because it's in the cooling waters and everything.
No way of containing it. Okay, fine.
In fact, the US has drastically curtailed its production of tritium from its nuclear reactors because of environmental contamination that's going on.
Have we spoken about that before?
We might well have.
Maybe.
Done.
I think we have. Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay. So that's tritium is one issue.
Yeah.
Availability of lithium.
Yes.
Is another. These fucking neutrons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they are like, you've got to do something.
I mean, ironically, the sun doesn't have this problem.
Yeah.
Because it just uses normal hydrogen.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the sun is just a better version of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. Although we could use the nuclear fusion of the sun to drive, like, if we could capture sunlight and turn that into electricity, how would you do that?
Oh, that's a great idea.
Because then you've got a fusion reactor that's sort of working really quite well, and you're using...
And a means of...
What an amazing thought.
Should be doing that.
Yeah, somebody should patent that.
Let's get on it.
Yeah.
Incredible, no one's thought of that before. We have. Well done.
And then you've got the parasitic power drain. So to power all of this stuff up takes a load of energy. Like,
oh, right. Yeah,
And to keep running it takes a load of energy. So I think the figures are like 20% of the energy you produce are just going to run the whole system.
But that, in fairness...
Which is fine, except when it's not working,
and
you've still got to buy in electricity from elsewhere.
Right. If it's working... That's completely fine.
Yeah, except the economics
you're only interested
of
in the
economics of scale. Sort of.
Well, yeah, but as long as you've got some net output, you're okay, aren't you?
You need to have quite a high net output. I mean, people have worked out the figures, but you can't operate like small fusion reactors and make money or sell electricity.
Okay, okay, okay.
You have to have a certain size of these things. But yeah,
I 100% know your position on this because you've spoken to me about it a great deal. You're very sceptical. What are industry experts saying? Do you trust any of them? Are there any industry experts who don't have skin in this?
So yes, in some ways. So there's a guy called Steve Cowley who I'm sure we've come across in the past, who is now working in the States, I think, at Princeton, and he's like, well, you know, this is all fine, and all this sort of private investment is fine, but you still have really fundamental problems to solve, and it's going to take us a long time. And he's been in the game, like, you know, probably 40 years. In fact, probably 40 years ago, he said, I think we'll have solved this in 40 years, and he's still saying pretty much the same thing. And this guy at Eurofusion, so this is a group of sort of national fusion labs, so the government, so they're not sort of, you know, partisan in some ways. He's called Tony Donne, and he says, he's the one who says it'll be the 2060s before we've got any appreciable amount of electricity coming out of a fusion reactor. So he's basically saying next, you know, another generation is required.
Yeah.
And let's remember, ITER is going to start even just experimentally sort of demonstrating proof of principle in 2035. That's 12 years from now.
Yeah, and probably won't happen.
And probably won't happen in 2035. So and then you've got to go away and turn that into a reactor. So all the lessons we've learned from ITER will probably take at least 20 years really to be... So, yeah, 2060.
How much of this do you think the British government are aware of? It's really, I'd love to, I don't think this would be possible, I'd love to just send this episode to
some key figures
and just say, have a quick listen, and then maybe modify some of the stuff that you say.
Yeah, and when you say this kind of thing, everyone's like, oh, you know, why are you being so negative about it? You know, that's like saying, oh, SpaceX can't do space because NASA hasn't done it. But NASA did put like 40 years in and people going to the moon and everything else. You know, NASA's got a lot of practical experience.
Well, to be fair, Elon Musk just managed to blow up another... rocket.
Yeah, and it was hailed as a great success.
Huge success.
Yeah, yeah. You know, people sort of say, oh, you know, you're just being negative about it. Why can't you be more positive? Why, you know, we've got to have that sort of adventurous spirit that says we can do this. But people have had that adventurous spirit since the 1950s.
Yeah, there's no dearth of that. Like, people want to do it. People are trying really hard.
It's really hard to do.
And they've got loads of money now to do it.
Yeah.
But it's still... not very close.
I think I'd have a self-driving car before I was getting my house powered by nuclear fusion.
That's a good one. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think you'll ever have a self-driving car. I think even if we do have self-driving cars, I think you'll own one.
True.
I don't think that'll be sort of the model for transport by then.
Yeah.
But it's kind of what
I'm saying.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you'll never have either.
Yeah, I'll be dead.
Oh, yeah, you will. Yeah, yeah, but I don't think you've got a long life expectancy.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london, or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.